I was born in India of missionary parents. My folks were church planters in India, and then when I was quite young in Scotland, and then latterly in England. So all the time I was growing up, I was in a church plant of one kind or another. That is my experience of church. Then when I trained for the ministry, my very first church was in inner city Birmingham. And that was a church that already existed, which was a new experience for me. But it was a replant. That is to say, all of the people coming to that church came from far away. They were elderly. They'd had an historic connection with the church. We're trying to keep it open. But the church needed to be replanted into the immediate community. So that was the challenge. And I really had no idea how to do that. I really didn't. I loved theology, but it didn't equip me to be a church planter, actually. Apart from maybe church history. That was the best. That was the closest. And a little bit of apologetics. But it was tough in that inner city, multiracial, working class community. Anyway, amazingly, the church did grow, and we eventually had 10 or 11 different nations, 40% Africa, Caribbean, 15% different Asian countries, and from there we started to plant out various places. My wife and I went to plant one church in our home in the suburbs of Birmingham, within smelling distance of Cadbury's chocolate factory. And that was the last church I planted until recently, when we just started again with a program in from our local church and also with the denomination of which I'm a part. So it's been a lifelong commitment to church planting. And in that context, I'm always interested to know, well, what's happening, what's taking place. And so recently we've been involved in some research. We don't have the finished research yet. This is something of an interim indicator of what we're beginning to discover. So, I'm an Anglo-Indian Scot with a lifelong commitment to church planting, particularly in a European context. Let me just give a few opening remarks in terms of the context in which we are now working. We have to view Europe these days in the context of the global, especially because the rest of the world is moving to Europe in significant numbers. And migration is one of a number of factors that's producing a new kind of Europe, which, although it is post-Christian in many important senses, it is also curiously post-secular. People are increasingly talking about this as a post-secular environment, and indeed are talking about secularism as just another one of the faiths that need to be encountered. The migrants that we're beginning to work with across Europe are not evenly spread. They're not living everywhere. They're living, first of all, in cities, for the most part, not in smaller towns and rural areas. There's some exceptions to that. For example, in Germany, you can certainly find smaller towns with significant Turkish communities, but that's unusual. Mostly, migrants, make their way to the larger cities. A lot of the time we look at migration and we see Islam, so it's good to just remind ourselves that most migrants that come to us from outside of Europe are in fact coming from a Christian background. That's not to say they are born again, practicing Christians, but that's their heritage. That's their orientation, and very often when they come to new cities, they look for a Christian community to be part of, to help support them, sustain them. As a matter of fact, I have a friend who is an Ethiopian church planter, and he's in the city of Leeds. If you know England at all, it's a northern industrial city. And I asked him how he started the church, and he said, I started it by standing at the bus stop, the main bus terminal in town. And I just waited for Ethiopians to arrive. And every time they arrived, I greeted them in their language and asked them if they needed help. It's not a strategy I would have thought of for church planting, to wait at a bus stop, but it worked in that particular case. We're beginning to sense, those of us who are involved in church planting, that right across Europe, there is a new energy around church planting. It's quite noticeable, actually. And so we're seeing in many, many countries groupings, alliances, coalitions, forums. They've got various names, but they all basically boil down to the same thing, which is a recognition that in nation after nation after nation, more people are church planting. And so that's a very important issue. If it's happening in that kind of way right across Europe, we need to be asking the question, well, what is God up to in this particular area? What is going on that's special? To some extent, it is migrant churches that have helped to generate that energy, sometimes spectacularly so. For example, in my own country, in the United Kingdom, one of the churches that is most active in church planting is called the Redeemed Christian Church of God. Now, you will meet them at some point, wherever you're living, really, because their mission statement is to plant a church within easy reach of every person on earth. So provided you're on earth, you're likely to come across them at some time. Very interesting group, primarily not just Nigerian, but Yoruba. And I say that because the point about the Yoruba is that they are Africa's largest tribe. And remember that that's pretty significant numerically, because one in four black Africans is in any case a Nigerian. So then you take the Yoruba, which is the largest group within Nigeria, you're talking about large numbers of people. Their self-description is that they are the Jews of Africa. And what they mean by that is they're entrepreneurial, they like to travel, there's a huge diaspora. So in the most surprising places on earth, you will find not just a Nigerian, but a Nigerian who is a Yoruba. Enterprising, and part of that enterprise is to want to start a church. In the United Kingdom, there was not a single congregation of the Redeemed Christian Church of God in 1990, not a single one. Today, there are more than 400, and they are opening congregations at the rate of 2 a week in the United Kingdom. However, they're not content with that, and they feel their progress is too slow. And I was recently speaking with one of their planters who told me that they had a problem. I said, what is your problem? He said, we've just had a phone call. This was last August. We've just had a phone call from our general overseer, Daddy, as they call him. And the general overseer had said, you must plant another 1,000 congregations. So I said, well, when do you have to plant them by? Last Christmas. Now, I don't know whether they actually did that, but when I said, well, will you achieve it? He just said, we have to. We must. We don't have a choice. So it just gives you a feel for, if you like, the, some would say aggression. I notice our Ukrainian friends use that term a lot this morning, aggression. I would say intentionality, because I'm English. We don't like the word aggression. So they're very intentional about what they're doing, and very interesting. So they, along with many others, are generating an energy around church planting. And for the first time that I'm aware of, in a very long time, possibly for 150 years, every denomination network in the United Kingdom actually has a church planting policy, because they recognize that without a church planting policy, it will be impossible to renew their denominational life. Now, that's not true across the whole of Europe, but it's the first time it's happened in the United Kingdom. They can point to somebody who has the responsibility. They can tell you what the strategy is. They can point to training programs, initiatives that are taking place. That's very new. Now, all of this is happening against a certain backdrop, of course, and there are certain unique elements about Europe that we have to bear in mind. The reality is that Christendom adds a particular flavor to the whole issue of church planting. And I don't mean necessarily active Christendom, but the fact that we have had Christendom for a very long time means that there are certain unique challenges to church planting in Europe that you don't necessarily find elsewhere. And one of those is the argument that Europeans are differently religious, not less religious, but differently religious. I don't know if you've come across that theory or not, but it was first issued by the sociologist Grace Davey. And her basic thesis is simply this, that Europeans are privately religious. And they operate their faith vicariously. That is to say, they are aware that because of the state church, others are doing religion, and they're content for them to do their religion for them. So what becomes important is the ability to have your child baptized, to be married in church, to be buried in church. These are the important points of connection for many, many Europeans. Now, I think that Grace Davis's picture of Europeans as not less religious but differently religious is actually accurate, but it's describing the past. It's not necessarily describing what's happening now, and it's not necessarily describing where we're going to be going to, because the truth is that the presence of Islam and the loss of connection with the Christian narrative, that loss of connection is so profound that actually the option of vicarious faith is falling away. And we see that in all sorts of ways. We see it in the fact that in some nations now, in Europe, less than 50% do actually have a Christian funeral. We're seeing it in the fact that in the Church of Sweden, which is no longer the established church in Sweden, we see that the number of those who are registering their babies through the church is less than 50% of live births. All these indicators are suggesting that soon it will be the case that in Europe, as in elsewhere, the only option is real faith or no faith. Vicarious faith describes the past. It will not describe our future. Now, within that context, though, church planting is often viewed through a lens of suspicion. And the reason for that is that there is a long history of church planting as a sectarian activity, even as a sheep-stealing activity. Certainly within living memory, there are denominations in Britain that have stood outside of the buildings of others and distributed tracts informing their members as to why they should leave that church and join another church. So church planting has had an unfortunate association with sectarianism in a divided Christendom, where actually, because loyalties to churches were very widespread, actually you were talking about competing loyalties. Now, it's only really in the last 20 or 30 years that church planting has had the potential to be seen as genuinely missional, genuinely something that is not sectarian, genuinely something that could be said to help not only the church that's doing the planting, but it has a benevolent impact around that church. In other words, you could expect now that a church which is engaged in mission through church planting will have some good impact on the growth of other churches. It's not in every case, but that's a shift from the way in which church planting sometimes took place. The other thing about Europe is that although we have a common history, we also have a perplexing diversity. In other words, there are certain things that you can say about Europe that are true everywhere in Europe, but you can't be certain. And there will always be some remarkable exceptions. We are certainly divided between what is generally true in the Catholic South and what is generally true in the Protestant North. Added to that complexity is the very different recent history between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. Added to that complexity is another layer whereby different nations, particularly in Western Europe, have understood secularism in different ways. So, for example, in France, the commitment of the French state to a secular ideology is very often rendered as being anti-clerical and quite aggressive towards faith of any kind. You'll know all the stories recently about the burqa and all of that kind of thing. Well, the same sorts of feelings have been felt in relation to the Christian faith in the past, and particularly with regard to Protestant churches. And you'll probably know that in the French language, usually a Protestant church is actually described as a cult, a cult in some kind of way. That's kind of the way in which the language itself pushes you. So there are all sorts of interesting overlays within Europe, different approaches to secularism, the difference between the Catholic South, the Protestant North, the differences between our history recently in East and West Europe, to name just a few. I think the other overlay which we need to take into account is the means by which, or the method, the original method by which a nation became Christian. Some nations became Christians because the king became Christian. Some nations became Christian actually through forced conversion. It was more than just the king becoming a Christian, but there was actually violence used to compel. But some nations became Christians willingly and with gladness. And there's a difference in that religious history in terms of the way in which the faith is regarded. So we do have a common history. Undoubtedly, the Bible was the narrative, the single narrative that took the stories of the tribes of Europe and welded them into a single story so that we might even think of ourselves as Europeans. I mean, it's an interesting thought, isn't it? Why is Europe even a continent? Because geographically it makes no sense. We're just a peninsula of Asia. But we think of ourselves as a continent only because of the Christian story. The boundaries of Europe are pretty much contiguous with the boundaries of the spread of the Christian narrative. So that's a complex history to take into account. So, with all that in mind, what about our research into mission and church planting? Well, first of all, the scope of the research is fairly limited. We recognize that at this stage, it will not be possible to track individual church plants. What we're trying to do is lay a framework so that at a later stage, we would be able to do that. In other words, we want to know at this stage who is doing what. Okay, we're not dealing with the precise statistics at this stage. We're trying to lay a framework to be able to get to that. Secondly, in terms of the background, we were encouraged, this is an organization called Eurochurch, we're encouraged to do this research because we're aware that there is a lot of duplication of effort. And particularly in terms of European networks, there's a lot of duplication of effort, and potentially, particularly around church planting. So, for example, Eurochurch, which I just mentioned, is interested in church planting. There is a former Dawn network that has brought together people around church planting. There is a church planting stream within Hope for Europe. There's a church planting stream within the European Leadership Forum. There's another group called the European Church Planters Network. And, you know, we could just keep going, listing all of these organizations. And at one level, it's great to see the energy and the initiative. But at another level also, we don't have so many resources that we can afford not to know what each other is doing and learn how to cooperate with each other. So part of the background is just to figure out who's actually doing what, how is that operating, and what are the kinds of emphases around that. Now, to that end, our process is simply this. So far, we've identified 1,600 people across Europe who we have been told are significant interlocutors. They're significant contact people who have information that we need. I guess myself, I just don't know at this stage because you only know what you know at a particular time, but my guess is that the real figure would be nearer 10,000 key people. But we're working with the 1,600 that we have right now. We have emailed those 1,600 people and we have had 400 responses. I'll tell you a bit more about the responses in a moment. From those 400 responses, we have produced an interim report. I'm very willing to email you that interim report if you would give me your email details. There you are. A willing volunteer to send it all out. Øyvind is going to do that. So thank you very much. Okay. Thanks for that interjection, Øyvind. So, we'll come to that in a moment. So that was a really good question, but thank you. That's always a sign that it's a good question. It's in the presentation later. Okay, thank you for that. Okay, so our hope is, and we're already beginning to discover this, we've sent out the report to all of those 1,600, and what's happening is that, you see, many of those 1,600 are the kind of people who are so busy doing church planting they don't want to answer our emails. I admire those people. That's really good. But they're also the kind of people who, when they read a report, they say, oh, I'm not in it. And, of course, they're only not in it because not because we've taken a special dislike to them, but because they didn't reply. So what we're finding is that sending out the report is actually producing another wave of responses. So that's very, very encouraging. However, there is a limit to how long we can wait, and so there is going to be a final report in October this year, and at least as far as this round is concerned, that will be as much as we do. Now, we do hope that we can find further funding to be able to take this to another few stages, because as any of you who've collected information like this will know, this kind of information degrades very, very quickly. And so having collected it, it would be really good to get some small amount of money to be able to keep upgrading the data. Now, the research has its limitations. First of all, there is an Anglo-Saxon bias. happen. There is an Anglo-Saxon bias to this research simply because those who are doing the research are located in an Anglo-Saxon setting. Inevitably, we start from where we are, from our existing knowledge. It is also very response dependent. In other words, it tends to be the case that the busiest people are the least likely to respond, and so that does slightly distort the findings. It's also true that at this stage it's short on analysis. In other words, there's lots of information about contacts and what they're doing and descriptions, but the analysis still needs to be done. So when you get the report, please bear in mind that it is interim and there will be a greater degree of analysis later. However, what we are beginning to learn are the following. First of all, we're getting a bit of a picture as to who is planting. Now, this is rather small print, so it may be that you can't see that at the back, in which case I apologize and I'll try my best to... Well, let me just test your eyesight. Can you read that at the back? You can. Okay. Ooh, excellent. You've got really good eyesight. Okay. So the responses were actually very varied. From the 400, there were more than 240 organizations, which varied from really very significant size of organizations right down to local churches. It's very clear that the majority of church planting is happening amongst Pentecostals and also new church networks. That would be charismatic-style denominations. But increasingly, the historic churches are beginning to report that they have some church planting activity. So, newer, but it is happening. There are also particular ethnic groups that are stronger than others. We've mentioned already about the Africans, particularly Nigerians, and particularly the Redeemed Christian Church of God. But also South Asians are increasingly active in church planting, as are Chinese people. It's also significant that Iranian churches are springing up all across Europe. And you're probably aware that God is doing an amazing thing with Iranian people at the moment. Both in Iran, where the government news agencies are indicating their increasing concern about the inclination of young people to become Christians. It's curious, actually, in the government agency news releases, they blame evangelicals for being so organized as targeting Iranian young people. They haven't met us. We're not that organized. But the Holy Spirit's very well organized in this particular regard. And through the Holy Spirit, all sorts of things are happening with Iranians all across Europe. I was in touch with a Methodist church in Bradford that's entirely full of converted Iranians. I came across a Baptist church in Cardiff that's full of converted Iranians, yeah.
Does that mean that Europeans are not planting churches?
No, we'll come to that. But this is just to pick out the particular ethnic groups that are figuring in the statistics. And I'm really talking about migrant ethnic groups. In one sense, that's not very good language, is it? Because we're all part of an ethnic group of one kind or another. But there are mission groups which are particularly active that are involving Europeans. Probably the most significant, just in terms of the number of workers, would be the Southern Baptists through the International Mission Board, the IMB. Southern Baptists have been present in church planting for a very long time, and they are a significant contributor to the scene. Also significant is an organization that perhaps is not quite so well known. OC, have you come across OC? It used to be called Overseas Crusades, but they've changed the meaning of OC now, and I can't remember what they've changed it to. I can't remember. It's something like Opportunity for Christ or something like that. I can't exactly remember. There's also GEM, the Greater European Mission, Greater Europe Mission, rather. Some of you may have come across GEM. Some of you may have come across ECM, European Christian Mission, which has its headquarters in the UK. Another group which has become quite significant, particularly in Eastern Europe, since 1990, is a Pentecostal group called Next Level. Have any of you come across Next Level? Yep, one or two. But not so well known. Well, they're very, very busy. They're very active. And I think you'll be hearing more of them recently. Another group which some of you may have come across, probably more in Western Europe than Eastern Europe, is Christian Associates. They try and plant English language congregations in the larger cities, particularly capital cities, and then from there they plant churches that operate in the language of the nation rather than in English. Last time I spoke to them, they were around about 50 significant size congregations across Europe, so quite busy. More recently, Acts 29, which is the group that Mark Driscoll's involved with, and a strong reformed emphasis in that group. And then, of course, there's also, not on this list, but you'll be aware of City to City, Tim Keeler's initiative. And there are several others which are beginning to show up on the radar with some significance. What networks are involved? We've mentioned this one already, ECPN, European Church Planting Network, which is really a training process to encourage those with an interest in church planting in Europe to be more productive. Eurochurch I've mentioned also, and there are a number of others that we also mentioned earlier. So a very wide range of involvement in all of this. What is it that people are planting? Are they doing replanting, or are they planting for the very first time? It would seem that the majority of these congregations are new plants, but increasingly, especially amongst the historic churches, the techniques or methodologies around church planting are being used to replant congregations that are at the point of closure or indeed have closed. Probably the best known example of this would be Holy Trinity Brompton in England, who over the last 20 years have replanted 20 congregations. And that's quite significant because for them that means sending out 100 or 200 people, and they would be expecting their congregations to be 500 or 1,000 quite quickly. So they've done a lot of that, and interestingly, they've made the commitment recently to planting 20 congregations a year for the next 20 years. Now, that's the kind of figures we wouldn't have heard 20 years ago. I mean, let's just stop and think about that for a minute. Let's say they're successful. 20 times 20, 400. Let's say they average 500 people per congregation, about 200,000 people. I mean, it's not a bad initiative for a local church, is it? Admittedly, it's not a normal local church, but it's a very interesting indicator of what's beginning to shift in terms of church planting in Europe. So there's a blurring of the distinction between planting and replanting, because very often exactly the same techniques are being used. The other thing that's coming on the scene increasingly is simple church in all its forms, and there are many forms of simple church: cell church, organic church, church planting movements. There are many words for simple churches of one kind or another, or even organic churches of one kind or another, these figures are beginning to show up as being a significant strand in church planting activity. So it's no longer the big thing like Christian Associates or the big thing like Holy Trinity Brompton. Very often it's smaller groups multiplying much more rapidly, as Neil Cole likes to say, more like rabbits than calves. So large numbers, but smaller beasts. Also new on the scene, but which is beginning to have an impact outside of the United Kingdom where it started, is the language of fresh expressions. Now, for those of you who don't know what that language means, the Archbishop of Canterbury sanctioned a development within the Church of England which was simply to say, we cannot say in the present circumstances what the future of the Church is going to be in terms of its style or its functioning, its model, and therefore we're going to embrace a mixed economy. We will no longer say that the only valid form of church is the traditional parish church. We're going to embrace a mixed economy, and we're going to encourage there to be fresh expressions of the church. And to that end, they passed a whole bunch of legislation that would mean that, for example, there's more than one route to being a full-time Christian worker in the Anglican Church now. So you can be ordained as a pioneer worker within the Anglican community. That's amazing. Because the people that are going to be ordained as pioneer workers, I've met them, they would never be vicars. They would never be traditional pastor teachers. They're a completely different kind of animal. They're entrepreneurs. And just releasing, therefore, a whole new kind of energy around leadership for church planting. So that's one thing that's happening. The other thing that's happening is there's legislation gone through the church which means that no longer can a vicar say, you can't do that in my parish. At one time, they had that ability to say, if you're an Anglican and I don't approve of it, you can't do it in my parish. Well, that's gone now, along with some other legislation changes in the Church of England, which really just promotes a whole new wave of enterprise and freedom. As one bishop put it the other day, he said, for the first time in my life, I'm having to run hard to keep up with the Church of England, which is great. So fresh expressions as an idea has been picked up definitely by Lutherans in various nations, by other denominations as well, who've seen that this is a way of lessening suspicion around church planting and enabling new life to take place. Now, let's be realistic about this. Not every fresh expression is necessarily completely new, shall we say, because it has become slightly the flavour of the month to have a fresh expression. So there's a danger that a vicar might say, I want to register a fresh expression on the website. What are we doing that we could call a fresh expression? I know there is that mother's service that we have now and again. I know we've been doing it for the last 30 years, but let's call it a fresh expression of church. So there's a little bit of that, but let's not be discouraged. Actually, there's much more of the fresh thinking and fresh enterprise. So it's an encouraging development. It's allowing the historic churches to engage with church planting differently. Where are churches being planted? Well, most of our initial contacts are city-based. And it's hard to know at this stage whether that means that most church plants are in the city or whether we just don't have enough contacts in the rural area. So we're not sure yet about what's happening in rural areas. There's a lack of information, which we hope to be able to rectify. It may be that there isn't enough activity in rural areas, or it may be that we're just not sophisticated enough yet to pick up what is happening. We've picked up some activity. For example, there's an initiative in England called Humber to the Wash, which is that big bit of England that sticks out on the map on the right-hand side. Humber to the Wash, that area has an initiative to have a live expression of the Christian church in every community from Humber to the Wash, and that's an interdenominational initiative from Catholics through to Pentecostals. It's quite astonishing, actually. And that's mostly rural-based. But we're not picking up a lot of those, so we're hoping there's more that we just haven't found yet. What nations more than others? Well, again, this tends to reflect our contact data. We have had in the research more information from the UK, but that's because where we're starting from. So the larger Western European nations are featuring more heavily in our responses. Actually, I was quite interested that France had so many responses. We haven't had sufficient responses from Eastern European nations, but that's simply because our starting base wasn't as good. And we're hoping that by the time the full report comes out, we will have put that right. So those have been the strongest responses. What do we still need to know? Well, there are potential gaps, but part of the problem, as you know, when you're doing research, is we don't know what we don't know. So as we're engaging in presentations like this, we're beginning to find out what it is that we don't know. And we need your assistance in helping us to point to that. There are almost certainly entire networks, I've heard of a few in the last couple of weeks, that we haven't identified, that we know absolutely nothing about, and we need to try and put that right. For some nations, the information is very, very limited. Our initial attempt was to primarily list the Western European nations, but as time has gone on, we just happen to have got more information from Central and Eastern Europe as well. So the boundaries have shifted slightly. There are some sensitivities around disclosure of information for obvious reasons, particularly those working with Islam. So there will be quite a few responses which are not in the report. So we'll have to try and find a way of alluding to those without actually saying what they are. But we're very, very rigorous in obviously respecting confidentiality as it's asked for. We need to find out why some have not responded. In some cases, we've discovered in conversation, how can I put it kindly? People didn't take the request very seriously. And through personal contact and personal conversation, they have resolved to repent and help us in the future. So we'll see if that does translate. I just kind of have the feeling that people who are church planters are the kind of people that don't like to fill in forms anyway. So we're probably dealing with some personality issues here. We might have to promise to send them converts in return for a form. I don't know what we'll have to do, but we haven't quite tapped into their motivation in every case. There's probably other kinds of information that we haven't yet collected. And again, what we're hoping to do at the end of this report is to gain some sense of, what did people actually ask us for that isn't in the report? Because what we've done is we've developed a mechanism now for going back and asking some additional questions. So part of the feedback mechanism here is, I would like you, when you do get the report, I would like you to ask yourself the question, well, what doesn't this tell me that maybe it could have told me and I'd like to know? Please tell us, because we will be able then to take that into account when we go the next round. We can go deeper with the information we've got, do more analysis. Might be interesting to know who's cooperating with who. In other words, what organizations work with other organizations. It might also be interesting to know who's working with what people groups. So there's all kinds of other things that we could discover. So what information do people want? I'm looking to you for feedback on that. So it could be how many churches are planted, what plans do you have for the future, where are the opportunities, what is different for you now compared to the past, what kinds of churches are you planting. Could be all sorts of questions that we've now got a framework to be able to use to get some of this information back. What can we learn? One of the things that's already obvious is that we don't have a good understanding yet for the way in which religious institutions are renewed. Now, that's quite a big subject. And it's a big topic of conversation amongst sociologists, for example. I don't know whether any of you have read the book or seen the book even. It's much talked about in England at the moment. It's called The Death of Christian Britain. It's just the kind of title to get you waking up in the morning with excitement. The Death of Christian Britain. And it's a very interesting argument because he's done a detailed sociological analysis that reveals that the faith is not being transmitted within families. And what he's saying is that that signals the death of institution. Which, of course, it does in one way. But there's a lot of evidence coming out to suggest that actually institutions are renewed not through the more successful transmission of the faith within families, but through the ability to make new converts. And that's not actually well understood. So there's quite a bit of work to do around this area. How are religious institutions renewed? Secondly, there's a lot of evidence beginning to emerge that suggests to us that church planting has the effect of being a laboratory. At this moment in time, the only thing we know for sure is that the things that we have done in the past are not working. But the next question is, well, then what will work? The jury's out on that question. Because the answer seems to be at the moment, a lot of different things will work in a lot of different situations depending on who's leading it. That's quite a confusing answer. So what we're seeing is that church planting is offering us the opportunity to experiment. In this time of transition, in this time when religious institutions as we know them are dying and potentially might be renewed, church planting is our research and development division to be able to figure out what actually might work in this new situation. And it's also becoming clear that international congregations are perhaps quite significant. Not because we're going to reach a whole nation through an international congregation, but because their size and the ability of the people who join such congregations, both in terms of their personal giftings, their level of education, and their financial muscle, means that these can be important sending congregations. And that is something that's beginning to emerge. So international congregations have a significance beyond their immediate numbers, because of who is in them. They're the kind of people that know how to think strategically. So they're a significant factor. I commented this morning that one of the other things that's happened in the last probably just 10 years now is the slight shift from the Bastide mentality to the mentality for cultural engagement. And what I mean by that is the Bastide in English is the fortified village. You will all know, I'm sure, that at one time England owned half of France. The best bit, with the wine. And for some strange reason, the French seemed to want it back. And we disagreed. So we had a battle that lasted 100 years, which eventually the French won. And relationships between France and England have not been strong ever since, really. It's been a problem. But in a vain attempt to keep parts of France, we built these fortified villages. Bastides don't work. It's not a way in which to conduct ourselves. And what has happened very often is that we've planted churches which have been cultural ghettos. Lots and lots of small congregations of 20 and 30 people that have seen themselves from the perspective of, now and again we will engage in some evangelism, we will get a scalp and we will bring the new convert back to the Bastide and make sure that the world does not harm them. You don't win a continent that way. And in the last 10 years, I've noticed that increasingly churches have emerged that have had the courage and the imagination and determination to engage with the culture in a new way. And that's very, very interesting. I think it's incredibly significant, too, because I want you to think for a moment of the case history of South America. Because the truth is that in the 1960s, the Protestant church in South America was largely composed of a Bastide mentality. In other words, tiny Protestant congregations full of people who were always arguing with each other, who were always splitting over small matters of doctrine, who were not well regarded by their neighbours, who had no connection with the culture. In fact, I would say it this way, if you wanted to be really, really depressed as a missionary in the 1960s, go to South America. That would depress you. I don't think anybody that was engaged in mission in South America in the 1960s could have predicted what has happened since. Where in some nations, those tiny, tiny congregations have become part of a Protestant community that's actually the majority of the population. It is actually quite astonishing. But here's the point. There was a moment when there was a shift in self-understanding amongst leaders and congregations. I think that's beginning to happen in Europe. And if it's true, then it marks a whole new departure. We're also moving from a consideration of how many, in other words, let's have more of, to asking a much more important question, which is, what are we actually planting? Are we going to plant the kind of congregation that has the ability to be self-replicating, to be imaginative and courageous, and to produce more of itself quite quickly? What are we planting, not just how many or more? And that's important because, as we were saying this morning, we happen to be living in a time of paradigm shift with regard to culture. It's the shift from the world of modernity, which we finally figured out how to evangelize. Took us a while, but we finally figured it out. We're leaving that world behind, and we're moving to a postmodern context, which is still a bit of a puzzle to Christians. How do we make sense of this new world? Church planting is going to be significant in terms of that paradigm shift, because we have got to learn not only how to engage differently with this culture, but we've got to learn how to imagine mission and ecclesiology, church, very, very differently. So next steps for us is that we want to provoke a response. From all of those 1,600 names, from some of the new connections that we've made as we've made some of these presentations in the last couple of weeks, and what we're hoping is that the full report will be much, much larger than the report, the interim report you'll receive. What we would ask when you receive the interim report through the email is please look at it from the perspective of your nation. What kind of stupid things have we said about you that you have the capacity to put right, because you have knowledge that we don't have, and ultimately we are reliant on your intelligence in both senses of the word to help us make a more complete and more accurate, more useful report.
Okay. Can you give us the top two or three trends that will come out in that report?
I think at the moment the main stuff is we've got an idea about who's doing what. Certainly there's an upsurge of activity. That's it's pretty basic, but actually it's very, very interesting nonetheless. I'm not certain at this stage whether we can describe some of the engagements with culture, but I'm hoping we can, because that would seem to be another trend, whereas in the past people would be planting churches that were essentially isolated from culture. The kinds of churches that we're seeing now are much more engaged, so hopefully we'll be able to describe some of that in a bit more detail. Do I mean connections with the media, or what do I mean when I say engagement with culture? I guess the most basic element is an awareness that you need to earn the right to speak to local communities. So basic service of a local community. Instead of seeing a community as, you know, you exist in order to provide us with members, it's seeing the community as people with deep needs that the church is called to address. So that would be the first piece of cultural engagement. But yes, increasingly engagement with media, with education, with arts, with politics. For example, one of the initiatives that's often connected to church planting in the UK is something called Redeeming Our Communities, where churches across towns and cities are coming together to work with the police, to work with city authorities, to bring redemption into the most needy communities. And that often means a church plant. As a matter of fact, that whole initiative came out of a church planting movement in some urban areas in Manchester. So it's a very interesting development. So quite widespread, really. Other trends concerning evangelism and all that kind of thing. To be honest, I think that's probably a second stage of research. Anecdotally, we're seeing that those church plants that are fairly, again, aggressive or intentional with young people are getting quite significant responses. But it's probably beyond the scope of this research to go into that in detail. But that's the kind of question that we would love to have back from people like you to say, look, please, would you do a bit more work on this? It's very interesting to see congregations emerging with large numbers of under 25-year-olds in them. So that's, and that's, I think, I don't remember that happening in European context for a very long time. Yeah.
Your opening statement was, we have been asked. So who asked you?
That's a good question.
Who are we beyond Eurochurch? What does that look like? Who are the people?
Yep.
How many are there? What kind of budget did you have to begin with?
And yep.
Do you need more funds and how much?
Yeah, these are really good questions. Okay. Okay, so a little bit more information about who the we is and who asked us to do it, detail around budgets and where did we start from, who did we ask? Okay, the we in this particular case is the organizing group or the steering group of Eurochurch.net. Eurochurch.net is the successor body to the previous European Church Growth Association. The funding came from McClellan. It was $25,000 US dollars, and we have primarily followed the natural leads that have come to us through the initially through the Eurochurch network, but then through ECPN. Other research bodies that have been sympathetic to what we're trying to do. For example, Daryl Jackson, if you know Daryl, has been very helpful at Redcliffe, yeah. So basically, we've just used our existing connections and contacts within the evangelical community to get as many names as we could initially. Does that answer? Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of, you asked the question also, what would we need from here on in? My guess from what I've seen so far is that you could probably maintain the information base for as little as $5,000 a year. Having got the information once, maintaining it is not as expensive. So I think something of that order, about $5,000 a year, would maintain the value of the data. Post-secular is that situation where, whereas at one time the secular mindset was able to say the whole of Europe is now secular, we no longer need God, we don't need to believe in God, and any kind of faith is at a disadvantage and on the margins, we've moved from there so that now people are able to say, well, actually, the majority of people do believe in God, actually. They are asking profoundly spiritual questions. And to be entirely secular is beginning to look strange. In fact, it's just another faith position. So that's kind of what I mean.
So it's like a spirituality without definition?
Well, it's a series of commitments. A secular approach to life has a series of faith commitments attached to it, which are sometimes hidden, but which actually can be drawn out.
Is that across Europe?
Is that across Europe? Well, the phrase actually first emerged among sociologists in the Netherlands, but I think it's actually not a bad descriptor of most of Europe. Less so possibly in France, for particular reasons, which I think you'll understand. But actually, it's happening enough that I think one could encourage that mentality to develop.
Does church size have an effect on the church growth or the church efficiency? You know, I've heard the truism or something that there's a certain size of a church that if it goes beyond that, it doesn't grow as effectively or multiply as effectively or maybe plant as many churches. I don't know if that's...
Yeah. Is there a certain efficiency related to size of church? The difficulty with that assertion is that you could certainly draw that conclusion from some stats. You could. But it's dependent on a number of other factors as well being present. So that's actually, I think that's quite a difficult one to maintain, because, for example, in the ethnic churches, it's actually the bigger churches that are doing the best. But then you're dealing with a very responsive situation, and you're also dealing with a situation which features a form of prosperity gospel. So actually, the bigger you are, the more attractive you are, because it seems that the more spiritual power you have. So I think that's actually quite a complicated question to tease out. What certainly does matter is the intentionality of the leadership, because often the energy for growth is being driven from the spirituality within that leadership team. So that I think would be just as important a factor as any other.
You mentioned something like prosperity gospel, but I mean, is it possible to seriously include prosperity gospel churches in a
yeah, is the prosperity gospel within the purvey of the Christian family? The difficulty with African prosperity gospel is that it's somewhat different from the American prosperity gospel, though they use the same language. But when you actually uncover what's meant, it looks a little different. And here's the issue. Probably none of us would want to say that God does not want us to prosper. The acid test is the cross still present? Now, I have to say that in some versions of the prosperity gospel that I've come across in the United States, I think the cross has been removed, in which case it's no longer Orthodox Christianity. But I don't see that in the African churches. They understand that suffering is part of the deal, which isn't classical prosperity. You know, I had a prosperity preacher in America say to me once, "Martin, if only you had enough faith, God would give you a yacht." Well, that got me thinking a bit. Actually, I don't like sailing, so that wasn't the issue. But, you know, I was thinking, so did Paul lack faith? Because not only did he not have his own yacht, but when he was on a boat, it had a tendency to sink. So, you know, what are we really talking about here? So, obviously, the minute you remove suffering, the disciplined life, the cross from the gospel, it's all over, folks.
I think, I mean, I hear all that. I'm just wondering what you include in the survey.
African churches are notoriously difficult to pin down on some of these points, so they are included for the moment anyway.
Is that Yoruba group that you mentioned?
The Yoruba group would... I think they are included. I think they'd be a bit light on the prosperity teaching, actually. I mean, if you've ever attended their all-night prayer meetings, you'll know that they understand suffering all right. very interesting. 50,000 people in an all-night prayer meeting in London twice a year. It's quite amazing. And then there's a youth meeting on top. It's just very, very interesting.
So in general, your theological basis for including as Christian would be Luzon, or would it be Evangelical Alliance? Or
because our contacts have tended to come through evangelical agencies, they would tend to be from that evangelical stance. That's where they would tend to come from. I mean, basically, we're talking about Trinitarian churches.
Same standard as Operation World.
Yeah, that would be a fair comment. Yeah.
What is the trend in terms of the number of Christians in Europe in relative terms?
Yep. Okay, what is the trend in terms of the number of Christians in Europe? To be really honest, our survey material wouldn't tell us that. I mean, I would argue from other data that we've come across in the course of this that we're at a tipping point. So, for example, in the United Kingdom, I could say that the evidence for the last 5 years is that the church is neither declining nor growing, which hides two other realities, which is that some churches are declining very, very fast and some are growing very, very fast. But overall, we're about static in the UK. I'm getting similar reports back from a number of Northern European countries. The situation in Southern Europe is obviously very, very different because of the collapse of the Roman Catholic Church. So it's quite a complicated picture. Folks, I think we're probably...
just add one comment. You have to do this sign-on, no, evaluation form. The people in the network, Church Planting Network, got a DVD. We have done a 80-minute documentary of church planting in Norway that shows different kinds of church planting. It's English texted, so it's possible to understand. So I have 10 more if someone wants one of these copies.
There you go.
And you can get it. And the second thing is that I think, like what we do and what marketing, research is extremely important. We have done research for 20 years in Norway. And now we have a website with all churches there, every new church. We try to find out, we try to see. Like we just registered nearly 100 immigrant churches in Oslo. It's preaching on 37 languages on the service of meetings on 37 languages in the capital area. And I think these things is important. I don't know if you remember what it was Oskinis, but he said, the speaker before in the evening, he said that there needs always to be some critical part and reflection of the church. Research shows facts often, and we try to find facts. And that's a critical, it helps us to really think what types of churches, what are growing, what are not growing, why it's growing. It's more of a question that is really important. So I think in all nations, if it's Holland or Spain or Germany or whatever nation, it's important that we start to really ask us the hard question, what is really happening? And I think that will help us to a dialogue in Europe where we can have a healthy speaking together on facts of really challenging each other, what is happening, not just what's there.
Yeah. And just to round that off, I think if one impression remains with me, it's simply this, that there's much more happening than we know. And I think the more we can unearth, the more interesting that is. Folks, I think you've been very well behaved, and in England we give time off for good behaviour. So we're going to release you a little bit early. But before we do... may we just close in prayer? Would that be okay with you? So, Heavenly Father, we thank you for this continent of Europe, which has had the blessings of the gospel. And we felt the blessings, even in the idea that it's good to be kind. So we're grateful, Father, for that, and we want to see our children, our grandchildren, future generations enjoying the benefits of the gospel. We repent for all that has gone wrong with the church in these times. And we rejoice that you have not left us without your Holy Spirit, who is even now going ahead of us to prepare the ground for a mighty harvest. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear what you are saying and doing in this continent of ours. In Jesus' name, amen.